China's president says the dollar's glory days are behind it.
Marketplace Morning Report is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
From American Public Media in Los Angeles, good morning. I'm Steve Chiatakis. Now the morning open, a look at business and the economy as Wall Street gets started for the day. China's President Hu Jintao meets with President Obama in Washington this week. The two men have lots to discuss. China doesn't like U.S. monetary policy of buying up bonds, which lowers long-term interest rates here. The U.S. has complained about China's artificial undervaluing of its currency, the yuan. Hu tells the Wall Street Journal he'd like to see the yuan become a global currency, telling the journal that the dollar-dominated reserve currency is, quote, a thing of the past. Julia Coronado is chief economist at the investment bank BNP Paribas, and she's with us live from New York this morning. Good morning, Julia.
Good morning.
How important are Hu's remarks?
Well, I think they're important for a couple of reasons. One, he is taking a diplomatic tone, so there's a desire for diplomacy and cooperation with the U.S. But they do strike an increasingly confident tone that we're seeing amongst Chinese policymakers. They really want to be setting the global agenda.
Well, you certainly need confidence to move forward. So what is China's long-term monetary strategy, Julia?
Well, it's a big question mark. China is facing a conflict. On the one hand, they do want to play a bigger role in the global economy. On the other hand, they want to maintain absolute control and peg their currency to the dollar. But being an international currency by definition means giving up some control. So I think it's far from clear that this is going to be a successful experiment.
Julia Coronado, chief economist at the investment bank BNP Paribas, joining us from New York. Julia, thank you.
My pleasure.
It may take a little while, but the insurance giant AIG is on the road to repaying billions it got in bailouts. Taxpayers pulled the company out of the financial abyss during the meltdown more than 2 years ago. The U.S. Treasury stands to break even, and there's going to be a nice bonus for one of the big banks that got bailouts of its own. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports.
The U.S. Treasury and AIG have taken pitches from a who's who of investment banking, Goldman Sachs, B of A, Citigroup, and others. They want to underwrite AIG's first stock offering since the bailout and takeover by U.S. taxpayers. Their potential profit, $300 million. Bank analyst Bert Ely says they'll have to work for it.
The real challenge is to be able to get top dollar for what had been damaged goods.
Damaged because of AIG's legacy of catastrophic financial risks. The underwriters will have to convince investors they're buying a different AIG, safe, streamlined, and poised for profit, selling boring old insurance. University of Portland finance professor Richard Gritta says this is a bailout story turned good.
Government has kept the financial system in place by bailing out a couple of key firms, and the taxpayer's not going to have paid a dime.
It's likely the government will recoup its remaining $50 billion investment when AIG sells stock later this year. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
BP may still have a dark cloud here in the U.S. after last year's oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico, but it still has important friends, and possibly a new best friend in Russia. A $16 billion deal gives the oil giant almost 10% of Kremlin-controlled Rosneft, which in turn takes a 5% share in BP. Peter Van Dyke reports from Moscow.
No international oil major is more deeply involved in Russia than BP, and after more than a decade of ups and downs, it knows the potential pitfalls all too well. But with the shadow of the Gulf of Mexico spill casting doubts about its ability to grow in the US, the unprecedented share swap may have been too good to refuse. The deal effectively replaces, at half the price, the reserves BP sold to pay for the Gulf spill, and it gives the company access to billions of barrels of oil thought to lie beneath the Arctic Sea. Ivan Mazalov of Prosperity Capital Partners Brokerage in Moscow says BP had little choice.
In the United States, which is the most important part of the world for BP, BP was rather burned recently. I think that BP may have had to reevaluate their strategic priorities and put more emphasis on diversification from the United States even.
BP's CEO denies his company is running away from the US, which accounts for a quarter of its oil and 40% of its profits. But lawmakers in Washington have raised fears over national security concerns. One says the company, once known as British Petroleum, should now be called Bolshoi Petroleum. For Marketplace, I'm Peter Van Dyke in Moscow.
Finance ministers from the Eurozone group of countries are meeting in Brussels later this afternoon. Number one on the agenda there, taking an even bigger whack at the debt crisis in Europe, as in making the bailout fund bigger for other countries in debt trouble. Christopher Worth has more from London.
Last year, the Eurozone crisis was all about bailing out Greece and Ireland. Now, the focus is on Portugal, and Spain could be next. At that point, analyst Andrew Lillico of Europe Economics says the crisis becomes a whole other ballgame.
Well, Spain as an economy will be larger, much larger, than Greece, Ireland, and Portugal put together.
Spain is Europe's fourth largest economy, which is why some European leaders want to expand the size of the roughly $600 billion bailout fund, or make it possible to use that money to buy up government bonds of countries facing rising borrowing costs. But Jonathan Loins of Capital Economics says there is one major roadblock standing in the way of that plan: Germany.
So far, it's dragged its heels with regards to almost every policy response that we've seen to the crisis.
And it's doing the same now, mostly because German taxpayers say they're tired of footing the bill. As Europe's largest and strongest economy, it pays the bulk of what goes into the bailout fund. So it's likely that no action will be taken in Brussels until the next Eurozone country reaches the brink of defaulting on its debt. In London, I'm Christopher Worth for Marketplace.
And where's Wall Street? No trading on Wall Street today. Wall Street's on holiday because of the Martin Luther King Day holiday. Global shares are mostly mixed at the moment. Europe's mostly down, but we saw some action in Asia today. Apple CEO Steve Jobs said he's taking a medical leave of absence, but he's going to stay on as CEO of that company. Troops in Tunisia fired water cannons and tear gas against hundreds of demonstrators in the center of the capital, Tunis. With protests in their second month and the government in tatters, how is the Tunisian economy holding up? The BBC's North Africa correspondent John Line is with us now from Cairo. Hi, John.
Good morning.
What kind of effects are we seeing from this violence in the Tunisian economy?
Well, obviously, there's an immediate disruption, most obviously, to the tourist industry, but more widely. People can't get to work at the moment. Economists are saying that dislocation could continue for weeks and months, pushing output down from perhaps 5%, 5.5% growth in previous years to around 3 or 4%. But at the same time, they're quite optimistic that in future years, growth could pick up. They say that the government of President Ben Ali, that's been ousted, was holding them back with its corruption and mismanagement, and the prospects, if the country stabilizes, could be very good.
You talk about output, John. What does the Tunisian economy rely on?
They have tourism, but they also have manufacturing, they have agriculture, they have mining. It's a very well-educated population and a very well-trained population with things like engineering skills. So it's a great base for manufacturers like Airbus, manufacturers from the United States and Europe, to set up not far from their European markets.
The BBC's John Lyne in Cairo. John, thank you.
My pleasure.
You're listening to the Midday Update for Monday, January 17th, Martin Luther King Day at Marketplace.org. Check out the numbers at our website as well. Here's a marketing tactic big in supermarkets and at the warehouse clubs: food that you can try before you buy. But when some people eat those free samples, they're not thinking about buying the product. They're thinking about having a second helping. From Denver, Zachary Barr from Colorado Public Radio has a story.
There's so much free food at Costco, it helps to go in with a strategy. Here's Matt Hannons.
Start with the meats and cheeses and work my way down to the drinks.
Hannons at the rotisserie chicken and provolone cheese cart. So naturally, I assume this is his first stop. I tell him clear on the other side of the store, there's free Jell-O.
Already had some.
And then he tells me about another spot he's already visited.
There's a fellow over there with some kind of soda, I think, that was really good. So I'll probably wander back for some more of that.
You see, Hennon's well into his sampling circuit. He says he routinely circles the store, eating seconds and thirds, but he doesn't stop at every station.
I'm not a very picky eater, but some of the stuff in the health food section I'll avoid.
Kay Wilson runs the food demo program for Colorado Costco's. She says people do like the junkier foods best, cookies and candy in particular. And for very hungry shoppers like Matt Hannon, she has a message.
We want them to have all they want. There's no overindulging. If you're going to buy 10 pounds of something, you want to be sure it's something you're going to consume.
Giving out samples is part of Costco's business model, says supermarket analyst David Livingston. He notes other profitable grocers do it too.
There's just a high correlation with successfully run supermarkets and sampling.
Livingston points to Whole Foods and Trader Joe's.
And these two chains are probably two of the highest sales per square foot supermarkets in the United States.
So why doesn't every store do it? Livingston says a supermarket needs to have extra money and be certain that shoppers will like the food they're eating. In Denver, I'm Zachary Barr for Marketplace.
For urban farmers these days, forget the backyard chicken coops and the parsley gardens. Goats are all the rage. But raising goats isn't for rookies, oh no. As Brendan Francis Noonan found out when he visited writer Novella Carpenter at her urban farm in Oakland, California.
Goats are definitely advanced topics, and I would not recommend it as the first thing that you get unless you've researched the heck out of it. It ends up, you know, you spend a lot of money, and if you do a cost analysis, like if I looked at it like, how much would a quart of milk cost? I mean, it'd be like $10 or something.
Are they even legal to have?
Yeah, actually, it is legal to have goats in Oakland. You can't have male goats because male goats smell really bad, as I found out when we had Mr. Lincoln come visit the farm for a couple days for stud service.
Wait, Mr. Lincoln is the stud goat?
Yeah, Mr. Lincoln. He has a long, righteous beard. So he, like, kind of moved in with the girls, and at first they were playing it cool. You know, they didn't even look at him or pay attention, and then they started to smell that odor that he has.
Oh, Mr. Lincoln.
Oh, it's so alluring. And you know what that is? Is actually they pee on themselves.
Yeah. Well, can we meet the goats?
Yeah, let's go meet BB and Ginger.
Are they going to attack me?
Oh, they're sweet. Look at them. They're little angels. That's Ginger. And then that's BB. These guys are both pregnant. Maybe you can't tell. The untrained eye might not be able to.
Yeah, I can't tell. But I did notice she wasn't drinking.
Yeah, well, she's not smoking either. It's amazing what she's given up for these babies.
All right, well, the reason you have these goats isn't because they're cute, right?
Well, they're what I call pets with benefits. Their milk is so good. And then it makes really, really creamy, yummy cheese, too.
So how often do they have to be milked?
A lot of people who have goats milk them twice a day, but I want to have a social life, so I milk them only once a day.
What is their life expectancy?
An old goat, 12 years maybe, but after they are done giving birth, you can just send them off to some petting zoo.
How is she going to feel? Like, you know, you're not there for her golden years?
You know, it's not like that. We're not best friends, you know? We don't have, like, deep conversations over coffee.
Writer Novella Carpenter speaking with Brendan Francis Noonan of our sister show, The Dinner Party Download. That show, by the way, is available at our website, marketplace.org. And finally, while people cannot live on goat's milk alone, Chris Voigt found a way to solely live on potatoes. For 2 months, he did this. Au gratin, baked, French fries, you name it, Voigt's touting the health benefits of potatoes. Comes as no surprise, then, that the Washington State Potato Commission, for which Voigt works, rewarded his efforts by naming him Washington Potato Man of the Year. I'm Steve Chiotakis in Los Angeles. On Twitter at Radio Chio, online at marketplace.org, where you can grab the podcast while you're there. This is the Marketplace Morning Report.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.